My name is David Ryan. I'm the interim coordinator of Free Thinkers at UU Sarasota. I would like to welcome you and thank you for responding to our invitation to attend today. Our Free Thinkers briefings are evidence-based summaries of what the general public needs to know about complex issues in the fields of religion, morality, ethics, and justice. Today, our speaker is Paige Brown, who will speak on the topic, Can You Really Be a Free Thinker? Paige was a trial lawyer for 24 years. He has a long history of observing Buddhist cultures throughout the world and teaches Buddhist meditation. He practices Buddhism with the Mindfulness Meditation Center in Sarasota. He will spend most of the first hour with his briefing, and then we will have a question time that will last no later than 11:30. Paige?
Thank you. I always wanted to conduct a orchestra, so I'm using their music stand. I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm thrilled to see all of you out so early. I'm from Venice, so this is early. I can't give up on these old jokes. I've done that since I was in grade school. So what do you think? Are you a free thinker? If you have a piece of paper, and you do, if you got the handout, and you got a little pen, and if you don't, I can have somebody give you one. I'm going to show you some cards, and I just want you to follow my instructions, which are write what you initially see. Okay, these are my equivalent of flashcards, you know, a learning technique. So I just want you to write down what you see. We have a couple more, and then we'll get started. This is your first test. This is payback. I had to sit as a student so many years. Okay, here we go. What you see, your initial reaction, do it quickly. By the way, you're going to have trouble reading these charts because I'm old school. It doesn't matter. I'm going to say everything. So we'll move along after that. I'm pretty fast-paced usually. Are you a free thinker? What we've got to agree on a definition or maybe not. How about people throwing out things about what they think? First, raise your hands if you think you're a free thinker. Okay, about 50-50. Okay, what do you think a free thinker is?
Give the definition, your definition of free thinker.
I'm not going to give mine. I want yours.
Oh, okay.
I know what mine is. I don't know yours.
Oh, yeah, I got it.
Somebody raise their hand and give me a definition. Go ahead, sir.
No dogma.
No dogma. Okay. Yes, sir.
I believe in the power of doubt. I do not think out reassurances, but embrace the question, and I strive to challenge my own beliefs.
Okay. I'm just going to abbreviate it as power of doubt and challenge, right? Okay. Somebody else. Just a little phrase is okay. Open mind, I heard. No judgment? Okay. I'm going to do one or two more, and then that'll be enough. Yes, sir.
See what's in front of you without concept.
No concept. Okay, that's probably enough, but that's pretty darn good, isn't it? Everybody think those are pretty good things? Let me just... Sort of like the 60s, everybody thought they were free thinkers. But then they all showed up with dungarees and tie-dye shirts. So I don't know. What do you think? We all want to be free thinkers, don't we? Anybody not want to be a free thinker? Even though some of you don't think of yourselves as free thinkers. A free thinker. Okay, fair enough. So there might be conditions where That's not going to work out. Sort of like a higher power would know better than you. Mm-hmm.
I think I'd like to be a free observer.
Okay, free observer. Very good. Now, the Buddha, this is going to be from a Buddhist perspective. The Buddha said, question everything I say. Now, I think that might be a good guy to maybe listen to. That appealed to me. As a lawyer, believe me, we questioned everything. And we questioned it and questioned it and questioned it and questioned it. So Buddhism appealed to me because I like a guy who says, yeah, I'm going to tell you something, and then you question it. And he said another thing. He said, all I'm teaching you, by the way, is suffering and the end of suffering. Now, the word he used wasn't suffering. He didn't speak English. Sanskrit, dukkha. And dukkha meant more than suffering. It's a bad translation in a way because it's very limited. But suffering is that sense of ill ease, anxiety, stress, all of those things, a sense of dissatisfaction. So he saw himself and everyone walking around with these senses of dissatisfaction. And he said, I'm going to figure this out. And he spent years as a soul jungle wanderer. He had 5 followers who abandoned him in the end when he started eating again, eating normally, because they believed you had to starve your way to enlightenment, or awakening is the term I'd like to use. But what he saw was he had 6 senses. He started very fundamentally. Oh, by the way, I do want to give you, before we move on, Merriam's dictionary says, it's a person who forms his or her own opinions about important matters, subjects such as religion and politics, instead of accepting what other people say. That's what they say. Well, now I'm going to talk about what the Buddha says. And so he says, the first thing we got to do is understand ourselves. So we're going to build a foundation of beliefs. And the Buddha would not answer, for example, the question, is there a God? The Buddha never said there's a God or there isn't. It's unknowable. And you can live a life, he believed, free of dukkha, suffering, without answering that question. Now, some people may think you're going to have to answer it, but can we answer it? I mean, does anybody? So the Buddha didn't want to alienate anyone, I guess, because he said, well, I'm not going to answer that. Now, I say he didn't want to alienate anybody. At the time, the religion in the area was a religion that led to Hinduism. It was like a premature Hinduism, very basic. And they were called Brahmins. So he said, well, you don't need to be a priest, so I'm going to use the word Brahmin, in Buddhism to mean anybody who's awakened. So any of you can be Brahmins just by awakening. And here's what he said we are. Now, he didn't use the word amygdala, but I do have amygdala down here. That's fight or flight. We all pretty much know what that is. Bam, bam, bam. You know, somebody pulls out next to you and you immediately hit the brake. Fight or flight. But we have 6 senses. I bet you can all get them. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. Often we talk about 5 senses. He said there's a 6th one. Mind, meaning thought or thinking. Are we all on board so far? Now the next question is, what is the process? And the process is, there's something to be perceived, and there's the perception organ. Let's do eye. It would be your eye for seeing. And the process of connecting the two. So I'm looking out here, and I see a lovely lady with a green top on. That's all eye. That's eye, correct? Is it? We'll get back to that in a second. But was what I just said all I perception? I will answer that, and you're correct. So you got to have all three. If there's nothing out there, it doesn't happen. If there's no consciousness going back and forth, it doesn't happen. And if there's no I, it doesn't happen. But now let's go to the I, the seeing. If it's my I seeing, then all I have to... I should be able to take that eye, and wherever it goes, like if even if it's removed from my brain, it would see, you know, it'd be all, the all-seeing eye. That's not what happens, does it? So what else is in there? Same with smell, taste, touch, all of them are the same. We mix them with one other thing, one of the other consciousnesses, don't we? Thinking. We're going to call it thinking, but yes. So I've got all these senses coming here, but then I've got one that's sort of a loop because it's taking, when I see her, and by the way, did I see lovely? I said this lovely lady. Did I see lovely? I did? If I saw lovely, everybody in the world would see lovely when they saw her. There'd be no dispute. There'd be no dispute. So obviously, thinking is playing a huge part. And that's what the Buddha saw. There's a problem with that. We have between 10,000 and 80,000 thoughts a day. If you're going to, do you think you could deal with those, that many? Anybody here think they could deal? The Buddhist tradition says it's 21,600. You know, we get more exact. But obviously you can't. So what are you doing? You're creating your own reality, aren't you? Because when you walk in this room, you choose what you see. I mean, you're looking in this direction. And maybe somebody's looking at my face, somebody's looking at my black shirt, maybe somebody's staring off at the pane glass windows. But we're choosing all the time, aren't we? So maybe that's what it's all about. Now, how are we free when we do that? Well, the Buddha, I bet everyone here has heard of karma. And what would you say was the definition of karma? Payback, consequence, go ahead. Okay. It all basically falls into that. The Buddha said, and it's in the Abhidharma Kosha, which is a writing, and by the way, we don't really know what the Buddha said because he lived 2,500 years ago before they wrote it down. And they memorize these things, so when you read the originals, they're pretty repetitive because they're trying to keep it in their minds. But karma is movement of the mind with varying degrees of intention, meaning, in effect, you're creating your own reality. And there's another consequence of that. You got no idea what my reality is. You're guessing. The only reality you can know is your own. Now, the Buddha only spoke in terms of six consciousnesses, but they added quickly. They needed a way to discuss the process he was talking about. So what they said is, we have what we call alaya. These are Sanskrit words. Alaya consciousness. And alaya consciousness is a storehouse consciousness. Everything that you ever did went in there. And have you ever had something like you see somebody and they trigger something and you go, what about Johnny Smith, who I haven't thought of in 50 years? That's your alaya consciousness. Something triggered it. And why did it trigger it? That's called karma. And that's why, you know, somebody did cause and effect or for karma and consequence. The problem is the consequence doesn't come when the cause comes. And so what happens is, who will I pick on? I don't know everybody here, so I'll pick on my friend Wolf, who's sitting back there. Wolf, yeah, he's trying to hide now. Wolf sees me and he says, "Paige, if I hear that story one more time, I'm going to shake your head." I go, "Screw you, Wolf." Good or bad conscious karma? What do you think? Bad karma. Probably. If he deserved it. No, I'm joking. Please don't take that serious. That goes in, I reacted. That went into my Aliya consciousness. The next time I see Wolf, guess what comes up? Or might, because I may have had a whole bunch of interrelationships with Wolf. That's right.
What comes out?
Hostility. If that's what I was feeling. I'm using a, It might be because I've known Wolf so many years that that's not what comes out. It might be something really nice comes out. But then let's say I know, I've never met you before, but you remind me of somebody I knew. Guess what comes up? Now, if you don't think that happens, I'm going to ask you just to stop a minute, and we're going to talk about brownies. You know, not the Girl Scouts, the food. And I want you to just sit there for a minute and close your eyes, and I'm going to ask you to do something. Now, you got to have your eyes closed to do this. See a brownie. Picture a brownie. Now let your mind smell it. Now let your mind taste it. Picture its shape. Just sit there and probably enjoy it, but just admit, reflect on the past experiences of a brownie. Okay, now you can open your eyes. My claim is that's your brownie. So when I hold up a brownie, I bring you a brownie. Sorry, I didn't. You don't see it. Your Aliya consciousness pops that up, and that's what you see. And then, because that doesn't agree with, it can't possibly agree with your last brownie experience, you may make some judgments. Like, what a cheapy Paige is, because he's given me a brownie that is only 1 by 1 inch. And the last one I had was 2.5 by 2.5. I bought it down in Venice. I can tell you the place to go, too. I mean, they're like a meal. So now my question to you are, is that free thinking? When that happens, is that free thinking? Oh, I don't want to leave out one other thing. They say we have also a manas consciousness. And manas, M-A-N-A-S, translates roughly, I, me, or mine. So now, not only do you have this thing pop up, you have this I, me, or mine, which is your, which is who you think you are. And if we have time today, I'll talk about that, because guess what Buddhism doesn't believe? Well, I'll give you a hint. We talk about not self, that we're not. I'm a walking not self. And my problem is I think I'm a self. So it gets filtered through that, and that's a little different than the Aliya consciousness, because it's the concept of what you're trying to hold on to. In my brownie allegory, that might mean I'm trying to hold on to the slim, trim, 125-pound Paige Brown that I knew when I was 20. So I've got this concept of self. So now I react to the brownie out of I, me, or mine and say, oh, loaded with calories, a bad brownie, bad brownie. So you see what's going on? Are you in control while that's going on? What do you think? Free thinkers. So I guess we're doomed forever because this is the cycle. Probably some of you have seen them. They're kept outside of all Buddhist temples in Tibet. It's called the Wheel of Life, and there's circles and circles. And basically the concept of that is, as long as you don't get this, and there are ways out of it, and the Buddha explained the ways, as long as you don't get this, all you're doing, you're like a little hamster in those things. You're just going round and round and round. And then we have the 12 links of dependent origination that say, we're just circling around. All of this, you're trapped. You're trapped in a circle. And every time you see somebody, you do this. We call it seeing, and then thinking. And then I'm off to the races. The first thing you experience are what we call Vedanas. They're feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Only three. If you could stop right there, your lives would be a heck of a lot easier. But what you do is, what do? Pleasant, grasp. Negative, aversion. And so that set the wheel in motion. And there we go. And there's, I'm not going to go through the 12 links because I don't want to give you data overload. But unless you learn to break that chain, you are the little hamster running round and round. And your mind is then like a computer. You know, it's like you Google. If you Google the same word over and over, are you going to get a different answer? I don't think so. Maybe 2 years later, when Google's changed things, a slightly different answer. But that's what you're doing. You're just pulling out karma. So how much of what we experience, this is a hard one to actually believe. It takes a while. But remember, the Buddha said, question everything I say. How much of what happens to you is karma? What percent? Anybody? No guesses.
I think a large percentage.
Okay, large percent.
90%.
90%. 100%. Until you are awakened, it is 100%. What happens with you? You see, objectively, I mean, I might be one of these religious fanatics, and I might have a whip, and I might do this, and I find that very satisfying, you know, to bring my blood to black, blood, bloody. Everybody else finds that a very adverse experience. But you see, the experience itself is neither of its own nature. Just to throw one more other thing out, the problem is you're shooting at moving targets because everything is changing. How much do you think is impermanent in this world? 100%. When you find an exception, please, my email's in the back, email me, because you and I are going to write a doctorate or something and become very famous. That's permanent. I guess he's got me. We're going to put that in all the journals. There is one thing permanent. It used to be, but I came from New Hampshire, and guess who we follow? The Red Sox. And guess who, during my entire life until I was aged or whatever,
they did win one.
They lost. Every year. I mean, it was called the curse of the Bambino because they got rid of the babe, I guess. So I thought the Red Sox losing was permanent. But you know, you even then, karma, right? I got to like that. That was a claim to fame, you know, the losers. How many people, by the way, I'm gonna give you a little test on that. Raise your hands if you think you can become enlightened. That means awakened. In this lifetime. Okay. Well, that's wonderful, because I should see 100%. I would say, in general, when I've asked that question, I found 85% don't believe they could do something. Guess what's stopping you from becoming awakened? Your own mind. Your own mind. Now, I think you've got in your hands here, if I can find my copy of it, a little page here. The four recognitions. All appearances are mind. Okay? The mind is empty. What do we mean by that? Well, remember we talked about thoughts? Those thoughts aren't always there. And the Buddha found that everything is arising and falling. Everything. So the thought rises and falls. Now, if you juggle it, the problem is you've got the past, the present, and the future. And some thoughts just go up a little bit in the air. And those are called thoughts. They just go right through your head. But then you don't want to leave it there often. So you throw up the ball higher. And that's a story. And then you throw the ball up to the ceiling. And that's an obsession. And that's what your mind is doing all the time. My question to you, and I'm going to, in a minute, show you a method of getting out of this, is how much of the time do you want to give away the power to be a free thinker? Because when you start doing this, if you go beyond just thought and do this, you're going to spend your life in stories and obsessions and very little of it living in the present. Am I saying just live in the present moment? Absolutely not. And that's one of the problems of the modern teachings you hear, you know, live in the now. Well, I'm going to suggest to you that somebody like Adolf Hitler lived in the now. He didn't. He had some obsessions. But you can live in the now in a very negative way. So the Buddha said, you've got to live in the now, understanding some of what, and a little more of what I'm saying right now. In other words, you had to have wise views. And this is where your religions come in, because guess what the wise views of the Buddha often turn out to be? Like the Ten Commandments, things like that. Because what happens if you do something, if I do something that harms you, what have I done? I've reacted to something and I put back in my consciousness, back in my alaya consciousness, a negative. And it's lying down there. And that's why the biggest crime of the criminal is not to us. It's to his own mind. Because he has just messed himself up. And that's why we have terms like life of crime. Because the habit he's reinforcing is a negative karmic imprint. Now the Buddha, after he became awakened, still had karma. He still suffered. He still had a lot going on. In one sense. The sense he didn't have is the karma rose. For example, he felt an unpleasant sensation and he let it go. Now, does that make you into a doormat? Because I always hear that. Oh, I'm just going to let everything go. No. What you can engage is your reactive mind. Then you have to allow wise view to kick in and react. For example, if my child behaved poorly, my reactive mind might reach out and just, you know, knock them down. I mean, I don't know. Something like that. But if I can catch my mind, and I don't mean for days, but just catch that first reaction and then give it an original thought. There is a free thinker. He or she is not living in reactive mind. Now, how did the Buddha ever get to there? He did a whole bunch of stuff, mainly meditation. Why meditate? And you're going to go, oh, here we go. He wants me to sit on a cushion and face the wall and chant Om Mani Padme Om, Om Mani Padme Om, Om Mani Padme Om. That's a universal, supposedly. The Buddha would say, you're making it up. The reason chanting works, because you're not thinking about something else when you're doing it. And I once did a whole day of it. And by the end of the day, you have like a little buzz, you know. It's like zzz. But meditate. The reason you meditate is so you can be the watcher. You can be the observer. You can slow it down so you can watch your own mind. So instead of when a car comes by and cuts me off, immediately throwing up my finger and screeching a word, none of which the other guy would hear probably. You might see my finger going up. That's a reactive mind. You would, in a meditation cushion, see that. I did a 30-day silent retreat in Thailand, in which we did exactly what you guys probably don't want to be doing, which is face a wall in silence from 5:30 in the morning till 11 at night. But we took little breaks. And every day we received an instruction. Life became hell for about 2 weeks because, remember all those stories? Now all you're seeing is your mind. And that's why meditation, even if you do it for 10, 15 minutes a day, you'll start to see what your mind is doing. You think, there's an incorrect statement. Impossible. Remember I said I can't possibly know what you think. I think you think that people and things out there are doing it to you. Nobody out there is doing anything to you. You are doing it to you. And that's why in meditation you will see, meditation is not about suppressing thoughts. It's about learning how to not react to them. So when I'm sitting, I'm going to show you mindfulness of breathing. We're going to do a couple minutes of it. When I'm sitting, up comes this thought. My wife yelled at me this morning, let's say. She didn't get up to see me off. That's what's bothering me. You know, it's not like the honeymoon days. She just stayed in bed. Now, what's that? That's a story, isn't it? When you're meditating, what you're going to do is go thinking, and let go of it. And if you get into the story, then you'd say story and let it go. But wherever it is, you let it go. Because what you're doing is watching your mind. I've got an itch while I'm sitting. Itch. You're going to just say feeling, and you're not going to itch it. Because I'm going to tell you what happens. Once you learn to watch, you realize that everything, we don't have like a sustained thought. What we have is instant neurological reactions. So it's rising, falling. If you don't grab on to that, it falls. So that itch of mine goes away. When you see a group of meditators that have been doing it for years, they will sit in a room and there won't be a movement. And the reason there won't be is because you realize that that's just feeling, and it goes away. And when you do this practice, if you have a pain, for example, look at the pain, look into the pain, and go feeling. It isn't pain, that's a label. You created pain. It was a sensation is what it really is. And that's why you have places like China where they operate on people with no anesthesia. I use the example of how powerful it is. How many remember the Vietnam War? How many remember the monk who immolated himself? And there's a picture, there's actually a video of him doing it. Now, I ask you, I made a picture of that just to remind me of how powerful the mind is. He sits there in a pose like this, in a monk's meditation position, and burns to death. Any of you ever been touched by fire or burner? How many of you think you could sit through that to the point where you died? I've also seen, you know, you see fires, what are people doing? Screaming and running. He went into a state of what we call absorption. It's a higher mental state. And sat there and burned to death. That's how powerful his mind is. And that's the only reason I use that example, is because people say, how powerful is my mind? That's how powerful it is. You think your mind's that strong?
No.
It is. You, what is going on is you don't believe it is, and nobody's taught you the practices that allow it. But your minds are that powerful. You just haven't employed that weapon, so to speak. The Buddha became awakened through the mindfulness of breathing. He sat under a tree and he went through four phases. And it's taught this way to this day. Long breath, phase one. Short breath, phase two. Body breath, phase three. And phase four is concentration. The first three are mindfulness stages. The last one is slightly different. It's a concentration stage. And that was his trick. People were doing one or the other. When you go into concentration, you go into eight higher mental states are possible. Basically, it's dropping everything and concentrating. When you do it, you will be amazed. Because the first stage is called piti, P-I-T-I, and it's, you will feel, you may, if you're really, you don't, by the way, if you haven't done this, you got no idea how advanced you are. There may be somebody here who will awaken today. The Buddha gave talks where people stood up and were awakened. On the other hand, Ananda, His chief secretary, never woke during the Buddha's lifetime. Was with him constantly, forever. And he's the one who memorized these. He had a photographic memory. Never awoke. And he awoke just before the first council in which they put down all these sutras. So you don't know who you are. It's like hitting a big rock here. I might be a diamond cutter and come up, look at that rock. Or I might be Wolf who does all this rock work. And just wham, shatters. Or I may, and I think here, now I'm describing myself. It's like bang, 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 forever, a long time. In general, prepare for a marathon. And what you've done, what we do as a society, is condition ourselves with negative karma. And why do I say that? Turn on the TV. And here's a car, and there's a beautiful lady on, you know, like I showed that woman from 10, Bo Derek, to you. Sitting on the car. What are they appealing to? They're appealing to what we call a hindrance, a negative karmic imprint of desire. They are trying to convince you, and they've been doing it all. By they, I mean society, our societies have been doing it all along since you were able to hear and anything. Condition us on desire. They want us to think that I can satisfy, they want me to think, I can satisfy my desires if only I get a bigger, nicer car. If only I have more attractive clothes. If only I pump iron at the gym and pay the guys to help me pump iron. Everywhere you turn. And by the way, I do it. I want my daughter to go to the best schools. I want this, that. There's nothing wrong with that stuff as long as you aren't addicted to it. You know, I'm now in my older years, so I need to trade my lovely wife of 40 years for a trophy wife of 18. And everybody laughs, but just turn on the news. How about the Donald? You know, he traded. Let's see, who else can we think has done the trade? So that's what we need to avoid.
Bo Derek's husband traded.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, what do you think? How much of a free thinker are you? By the way, when I held up the pictures, what did people write? I guess all I want to hear is, who wrote just the person's name, or, better yet, object or picture? Because I didn't ask, what did you think when you saw that picture? I asked, what did you see?
A piece of paper.
That, well, there's something on it. A piece of paper with something on it. But even the paper's a label. So, are you a free thinker if you've already prejudged? I mean, I was trying to use things people had a reaction to, and I had a whole bunch more, you know. But, you know, half the class group got excited when they saw George Bush in a positive way, and half got upset in a negative, if I'm guessing. But what you should have just seen is person. Or, you know, I'll give you George Bush, you know, but just the name. So there's where we go.
Is there such a thing as a free thinker?
Well, I'm going to let you answer that. I mean, I have my own personal opinion. Is there a free thinker? I have my own personal opinion. Well, I'm going to give you a choice now, folks. We can either do a meditation and you can look at your minds, or in the time frame I now have, or I can talk about that I, me, mine, what really is, what we mistake for an ego. So take your shot. Which would you rather do?
Both.
We don't have time for both. Meditate? Huh? You've done meditations before? Okay, I will go on to the other. I want to say this, however. You, in the theories we have, you cannot intellectualize your way to the answers. In that meditation, the Buddha found when you come out of concentration, when you come out of it, you see reality as it is. The absorptions, the higher mental states, are what, when you're in them, you will be unaware of time, place, any outside concepts. And you will have these sensations going through you that are very pleasurable. Okay, let's go on to the other. I think it's on the other side. Just so I gave you the six senses, and that's what we just went over in our own way. The Buddha, when he addressed who you are, said you're actually five, and he called them clusters, heaps, or aggregates, meaning, you know, just piles of thing. He didn't want you to identify it as such. And what are those? You don't need to... Oh, by the way, if you think the I, me, or remember the perceptions we just did? If I have longer, I really mess you up because there's a whole bunch more going on there, and we end up with something like this. But here's my version of who you are. The only part we need to really be aware of is anatta. It's called anatta, not, which translates roughly not self. Now, the Buddha didn't say you didn't have a self. He said what's going on is not self. What's the distinction? The distinction is you have an ego, don't you? But what is that? It's only a karmic creation of your own mind. That's not what's really going on. And because you think that's real, you think, I'm stupid, I'm fat, I'm gorgeous. And those are hindrances. Pride, arrogance, all of those things are hindrances. So the Buddha isn't going to tell you you don't have an ego. What he's going to tell you is you're making it up. And what you really have is five aggregates. Form, it's on your sheets too, feelings, perception, fabrications, and consciousness. We just went over the consciousnesses. Those are the six consciousnesses. Form is your, this is form, but we can't call it any more than that, or we're creating our own karmic world. Feelings, I meant, touched on that. The Vedanas, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. When I build on that, I build up an emotional world. And by the way, you go, well, what if I can just always build pleasant? You know, I'm always going to, let me get through this, and then we're going to have a half hour for questions. I'm going to have an ego that I'm protecting, aren't I? If I build beyond pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, I start getting myself in trouble. Because now I have a fixed view of myself, and when something doesn't line up, there it goes. So even though I had pleasant, I turned it into an emotion. Like I feel great passion and life and all this and that. And at some point, that's going to end, and that's called dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness. And you can see here, well, let me get through this. Now, the perception is, I look out here and I see just in general an object. When I start saying, lovely smiling woman with blue and white on, I'm creating a world again, aren't I? I come from the Middle East. Oh, totally exposed person. What is she doing without clothes on, basically? Right? Different perception, different world. Which world is right? Depends on who you're asking. So if I leave it at perception, but what do? I then do fabrication. I make up a story. That's fabrication. So there we are. That's all we are. And the worldly winds, what we call the worldly winds, blow against these things. So I have gain and loss, honor and disgrace, praise and blame, and happiness and pain. A positive and a negative, and there we go. Because we're trying to balance it or load it up with the affirmative sides of each of those. All of those things are just rising and falling. One minute I'm aware of my form, you know. I got a diet. Feelings. I look out and I see all these happy faces and I feel pleasant. But then I start building up a story. Everybody's pleasant out there. And then somebody frowns at me. And I go, whoa, unpleasant. You see what we're saying? This goes right back to that saying. We're creating our own worlds. You buying that? And then we're storing those worlds in our alaya consciousness, and that becomes our karma. Just to maybe follow through on this, the ego side of it would be desire, greed, hatred, delusion. We create all these hindrances, and those are anchoring negatively. And the Buddha would say, follow the Eightfold Path, and that's right view and seven more. that we won't go into right now, but positive mental states.
Particular way to doing our questions today, Lou's going to help me with this. We need you to raise your hands. We want you to ask your question on the microphone. One reason is because we're doing this. Lou's going to help. Yeah, thanks. We're going to fight over the mic. Do you have to go? Deanna and I will will do the mics today. If you'll just raise your hand, we will try to get you in the order that you raise them. First one will be over here. I saw.
What exactly do you mean by an awakening and enlightenment?
Tough question, really, because those who don't experience, I mean, I can't explain, I can only try to explain something that I have not experienced. But basically, an awakened person would not have negative mental states, and they would go through life basically seeing life in what we call the Brahma Viharas, the higher mental states. And those are loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. Buddhism is famous for its list. And you are awakened to reality as it is, not as you construct it. And as it is, there's no really good brief answer, but it's you have wise view, which means you not only understand, but live anatta, not self. You understand dukkha, or suffering, and you understand anicca, which means impermanence. So you would have a wise view, and you would live your life through these positive mental states. So, for example, if you yelled at me, I would not feel anger. I would feel a rising of an unpleasant feeling. I would see it for what it was and let it drop. And it would be filled with, then, compassion, because I would realize that you, to be angry, are suffering. You are experiencing dukkha and wrong view, not a wise view. So I would understand that I can't know what's going on out there, but I can experience what's going on out there in only positive mental states. And I use the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh as examples. They seem to be smiling even at inappropriate times. And the reason is because they are living, and you would be living not in the outer world, but in the inner self. So inside me, I would have this burning happiness going on. Why do I have to cede my power to you, to what's going on around me? Something that I know something's going on, but I realize it's my creation. And so my world would be a very, very happy world in that sense.
Anybody? Okay, I want to okay. Right here.
Yep. Right here. Go ahead.
I mean, that's very good to be a happy world.
Yep.
You know. My prayer is let me be out of my mind. But what about when the world is going bad? What do you do? Do you just live in your own world and be happy, happy?
Yeah.
Or do you try to do something about it?
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. It has a taste of, I call it the doormat theory. A Buddhist or someone living in that world would become a doormat. Everybody walk over them and so on. And the world is ugly out there. Well, that ugly world you are creating, that it exists only one place in your mind. Things are happening out there, but what is their nature you can't know. Now, there's what we call the bodhisattva vow. And that would be your guiding principle, which is to bring happiness to yourself. And by the way, it is yourself. You do begin with yourself. Because if yourself is not happy, you aren't going to be able to keep the second half of the vow, which is, and all the others. So then you would apply, you would not react initially. you would not just have a reactive karmic mind, you know, doing the loop. You would then do in your best judgment at that time, if you were awakened, it would be a perfect answer. And that's why the Buddha, when you read his teachings, they vary. And they vary based on his audience, because he had skillful means and deep understanding. So he could give a skillful answer, maybe a lot more skillful than I'm able to give. But you would then react. You would discern. I'm going to create, rather than reacting, you're going to discern the situation and do what would cause the most happiness to others. Somebody is out there trying to knife somebody. You wouldn't just stand by and say, I'm happy inside. You would skillfully, on the other hand, you might not shoot him if you knew you could reach out, because he's smaller than you, and grab the knife to stop the violence, because what you're trying to do is create happiness for others, and that's your goal. Do no harm, do good, and follow the teachings. So guided by that, that's how you would do it. It's really hard to get beyond reactive mind, though. Yep, next.
Any other questions? Anybody? Over here. Okay.
You talk about karma as being our self-creation, yet when I hear it, people using it all the time, it seems like they've lost control. They have no control. It's that word of fate, or that feeling of fate. Can you kind of address fate, or how people are using that and using karma?
Sure. Well, that's why you're doing the meditation, for example, is to slow things down so you can see what's going on. And once you realize that it's a mental state, you realize you can control your mental state. For example, all addictions are deep-seated mental states that habitually just recycle. And that's why it's very hard to break things like alcoholism and so on. There's no mindfulness involved. The karma, it's not amygdala, it's not fight or flight, but it's almost that fast. And it gets very, very powerful. And, you know, so you need to retrain your mind. And that's what that is. I want to say one thing about that. If any of you are interested, I have some cards in the back on my, there's a mindfulness center here that I attend. The fellow who I went to Thailand to see has moved here, and it's very powerful at teaching this, because it's not, I began this in 89, and I didn't really get it until somebody got me out of my head, thinking I could think my way, you know, lawyers, that we can think our way out of these things, you know, it's just a matter of the ands and buts, changing where they lay in the sentence.
We have a question here, and then over there.
Okay.
I think you may have partially just answered my question, but let me say it anyway. Karl Marx called religion the opiate of the people. How is Buddhism actually different than heroin?
Than what?
Heroin.
Heroin. Heroin.
Yes.
Well, heroin would cause addiction, wouldn't it? I think I answered it with the statement the Buddha said, question everything I say. I don't think Karl Marx said that. Buddhism is a non-theistic religion. And you, by the way, you can, comfortably follow almost any religion and do this. It's gotten labeled religion, but the Buddha didn't say, okay, here's my religion. He just said, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. Now, if you call that a religion, it's a religion. It's a philosophy. It's being used a lot. I hear modern psychology being taught, and I listen to it, and I realize they've just lifted these concepts. Cognitive therapy, very close. So I'm a cynic, and in the sense of I got to be showed kind of thing. And so what I'm saying is, as you learn these things, they got to make sense to you. In other words, religions quite often call for something out that is unknowable, and you couldn't know it. This is not calling for any of that. And it works. And I would say Karl Marx's system hasn't worked all that well in a lot of parts of the world. So if it doesn't work for you, walk away. Buddhists don't do, what's it called when I try and get you to join my movement?
Evangelize.
I'm not supposed to do that. Now I do it because I just, for me, I had some heavy mental burdens from the Vietnam era, and they were plaguing me a great deal. And this thing worked. It broke some really tough mental patterns.
Okay, we're ready back there and then up here.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I can express this. Can you hear me?
Apparently it's not on.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
I got it. Okay, I don't know whether I can express this right, but it seems as if in the process of achieving, say, even as much as you've achieved or as a lot that you have achieved, you kind of have to go inside yourself but outside yourself, in a sense, you know, so that you're not embroiled in the mush of the day. How do you, I still don't see, though, how you would have a passion for beauty and a passion for involvement if you're so intellectualized what you've done.
Okay. Yep. Real easy. Real easy for my source, anyway. There's eight jhanas. Those are higher mental states. And you've got to get into absorption. When you do, you will think you are in heavenly realms. They call them the Brahma-viharas, the higher realms. You will feel overwhelming joy. Pitti is often compared to the best sex you ever had. You have to get that. That's the experiential part. Otherwise, you will sit on a mat or in a chair and meditate and go, I've done this for 10 minutes. You know, when you're lost in Disneyland having a great time, you don't check your watch every 5 minutes. These inner mental states will become so positive. And that's why you need good guidance on how to get there. There's another practice. It's a beautiful one. I'll tell you two other practices quickly. These practices, you see, get you there. The mindfulness gets you into these higher mental states. There's also what we call the metta bhavana, loving kindness, in which you begin by wishing yourself loving kindness, and you warm yourself, and you see yourself just in loving kindness, because the mind is all powerful. You can create this. And you visit that, and then you wish it on others, and that's the bodhisattva vow. There's another one that I found very difficult at first. It's called Tonglin, just to touch another one. You breathe in the pain of the world. And you go, what? And then you breathe out joy. Now, I did that. When I first did that, that night I would literally have nightmares and bad dreams. I mean, it was really awful. Only when I found an instructor who said, you've made a mistake, and told me what it was, did that become a wonderful experience. And what it was is I had to first create a joyful inner peace within myself. And then that comes in and it's transformed, which is what you're doing with your own life. You're transforming it. So in one way, theoretically, you're bringing in the pain of others and transforming it into joy. But in another way, it's yourself. You're bringing in the pain that you've all experienced. And that's why I've found that the Buddhist groups, wherever I've been, and you know, I practiced it when I was in the north and here too, is usually older people. The young people last about 3 months. They're really fierce at it, and then they walk away and go look for that fancier car or the new wife. Up north, they were younger people. You come to Buddhism after you got divorced, and then when you find somebody, you leave it. And guess what? I bet they've repeated that pattern a few times. You know, serial experiencers. I mean, how many times do we have to go through things we know won't work? I mean, I used to buy new cars all the time. And man, that smell, it was worth it, that new car smell. And then I realized how much I was wasting effort and money and so on. And it's just, I haven't bought a new car in years. I trade old ones, you know. When it dies, kick it out and get another one, because that's not where I'm looking. Inner peace. You can really do it. Remember, this isn't just Buddhism. You could be here. Be still and know that I am God. What do you think they're looking for? Be still. Some voice, they're looking for that inner peace. I mean, all the religions have that element, often associated with the mystic elements of it, because it empowers, you know. Jesus didn't have priests with rules. That's sort of like a later add-on, isn't it? And paying for penance, how about that one? Jesus taught, look in.
Okay, we have one here.
You mentioned earlier something about breathing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Can you tell more about what you were talking?
Okay, yeah. A good trick, by the way, is you learn on the couch that your breath, there are early warning signs of where you're going. The problem is you don't notice them. One of them is your breath. I defy you to stay angry with deep breaths. On the other hand, with short breaths, there's a good chance you're angry. So that's one signal. Just as the feeling of pleasant or unpleasant is an early warning signal. These can help you catch yourself before you go into your stories. The mindfulness of breathing teaching, and you can look it up on the internet and it'll show you the stages, is to get you settled so that you can see your mind and see what's going on. And you become the watcher, and you label what's going on and let it go. Just keep labeling. There's something about it that the power is taken away. I don't know why it works, you know, but I know it works. That if you label something, you take the power away. When I did the 30-day retreat, I didn't stop thinking. What happened as the time went on is the emotion was gone. So thought rise and fall. And by the way, it was my experience, and this is why it may not happen quickly. When I moved my biggest issues off the table, in come some new issues. And you'll find as you go along. I never thought I had repressed memories, but I do. The problem or good thing about it is my mind was so busy, the repressed stayed repressed. But that you're going to have to let them come and walk off. But you've now learned the technique of letting them just come and go. So the first ones, getting them off the table, was a lot harder. But once you have the technique, it works all the time, 100% of the time. And some big ones, and you don't have new issues. You know that first divorce where you spent $150,000 and battled away and then got the settlement the lawyer told you you'd get the first day, but, you know, you were going to get revenge? I mean, I once saw a woman, the guy being out of the house and he wasn't allowed back in, the court ordered us as lawyers to go down there. And so he could get some of his clothes. He's throwing them into garbage bags. His little dog comes out, their little dog, wags its tail. It's all excited. My client, the woman, lady, grabs the dog, puts it up on the table, and starts scolding it. He's a bad man. You should not. How's that? How's that for mental torment? Well, your second or third divorce, maybe you start catching on that something else is going on here. By six, you know, Liz Taylor.
Mickey Rooney,
yeah. Well, I had the best of all. Here's my claim to fame. I had a woman who'd been divorced 6 times, but as she clearly pointed out to me, she'd only had 3 husbands. She believed in giving everybody, these are her words, a second chance.
Yes, we have a man who runs the Environment Committee in the House of Representatives. His name is Imhoff.
Name?
Imhoff. Mm-hmm. He refuses to address any legislation that would do something about climate change, global warming, which the scientific community has almost universally accepted. And why? Because he believes that if God wanted something terrible to happen to the planet, he would do that, and we are at his mercy. Now, how do I find the inner peace not to want to strangle this guy?
The same way I found the inner peace, because I don't believe in global warming as the cause of the end of the world, that I happen to believe that we're about to go into another global cooling and that the oceans are actually dropping. How's that for a different opinion? You're creating your own world, aren't you? Your world isn't wrong, and my world isn't wrong. They aren't right either, but they are our worlds. Well, scientific evidence would be something like, to me, gravity. We don't need to interpret anything. I mean, I just let something go, and it drops. The Buddha taught 2,500 years ago, and the methods that he taught, I happen to believe, work. The meditation methods. Just sitting for a beginner is not a good way to start. You need some guidance, or your crazy mind is just going to take you all over the place. So you need guidance about labeling and so on. So you need to find a place that teaches some kind of fundamental meditation. The place I go, Mindfulness Meditation Centers, they meet on Sundays and have just a general discussion, and then Tuesday nights, and this is all at the Prana Center, and they do courses. For example, what I just did here, if you got it all, you are really great, because I've spent weekends on it, weekend retreats, a lot of time. So anyway, that's MMC. Like I said, the card's back there. And if you want, people can leave me an email. I'm happy to give you more clear advice to your particular.
Is that by the bicycle shop?
Yeah, between the two.
What's the name of your teacher?
Michael Gregory.
He was here once.
He could have been, yes.
Was he? Okay.
There's also a group that meets here at the church on Sunday evenings. Anybody here who a member of that? It's 7 o'clock, I believe. 7 o'clock on Sunday nights.
Okay,
in the Jefferson Center. Okay, so that's here too.
Yeah, you need on this note, here might be a great place. I'm recommending you do something rather than nothing, and it may be like everything else, you know, the Porsche's for you or the Jaguar kind of thing. I like it like strong and in my face, but there are others that are really low key. It's what you need, and so if you don't hit it right away, don't abandon it. Just find somebody. Even do it online or do it on your own. You're not going to think your way through this. If that was true, they'd have a course at every university called Enlightenment. Probably 401.
Yeah. We have another. Wait.
Sorry. I just have a practical question. Is Michael Gregory teaching at the Mindfulness Center?
Yes.
Because he has another place.
In Palmetto, we do over weekend retreats. And during the summer, this summer in particular, you can do the exact retreat I had to go to Thailand to do, which is called Mahamudra teaching, which is the first four stages of 16.
Any last questions before we break? Paige, we're very happy to have you here, and thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. I a lawyer always has to get the last word in. I'm really thrilled you came. And to me, what really keeps me going is the fact that you come to places and do things. And you should be proud of yourself. I think you're in the top 1% in the spiritual thing. You know, we have these income ones, that you have that curiosity. Because as long as that curiosity fuels you, you will find a path. And you will make this world a better place.